sweating. This must be going to be a hot sermon. All right. Chapter 9, book of Job. Chapter 9, book of Job. All right. Are you right, are you wrong, or are you both? Let me ask you some questions. Do you believe that everything you know or believe about God is right or correct? Well, if you're smart, you know there's a real possibility that you could be wrong. And you could be wrong about quite a few things about the things we believe about God. So let me narrow the focus to just one of God's attributes. Do you believe that God is sovereign? Okay. So now let me ask you this. Are you sure that everything you know about the sovereignty of God is correct? Sure. None of us knows everything is correct about what we believe about the sovereignty of God. But you do believe in the sovereignty of God, right? All right, God is sovereign. Now let me ask you this. Since you believe that God is sovereign, is there any doubt in your mind that there could be some possibility that you are wrong about what you've been taught, about what you know about the character and nature of God? Is there any possibility you could be wrong about that? So, you could be wrong about some of the things that you believe about God and about the sovereignty of God. So then, it's possible, as Pastor Ash suggests, to be wrong and to be right about what we know about God at the same time, right? For example, I know people who say that God is sovereign. They say he's sovereign and then turn right around and say that God needs our permission to do anything in the earthly realm. Now, what does God need our permission for? Well, if you read Psalms 115:3 and Psalms 135:6, you see that God does all his good pleasure. He does what, in other words, he does whatever he wants to. Where at? In the heavens and in the earth. God does all his good pleasure. And then in chapter 42, verse 7, God says that Job has spoken rightly about him, yet Job says some things about God that are, frankly, way out in left field. They are just plain wrong. And we've already seen that almost every time Job has spoken thus far. So when we listen to Job's speeches, what we need to do is bear in mind the distinction between Job's perceptions and Job's heart. Ash goes on to say this about Job. His heart is the heart of a believer, which is why God commends and affirms him in the end. But his perceptions of God, much like ours, are partial and flawed. We hear in his speeches the honest grapplings of a real believer with a heart for God as he sees what he thought was a secure worldview crumble around him. And as he does so, he accuses God of some awful things. Remember, his worldview was much the same as his friends until when? Until he was afflicted, right? Until he was afflicted. And that's why we will hear Job say some things that are just plain wrong, and yet we hear him say them from a heart that is deeply right. Both Job and his friends get some things right, and they get some things wrong. But Job, now listen, he is in the process of learning some things he would have otherwise never learned without having been afflicted. I think it becomes apparent from hearing Job speak that he is struggling with distinguishing the difference between the character and nature of God and the actions of God. For example, we can't see the wind itself, but we sure see and experience the effects of the wind, don't we? Sure we do. Well, the same is true of God. Job, while he can't see God, does see and experience what he believes are the actions of God. And like us, Job believes in the sovereignty of God. So, since God is sovereign, and Job believes nothing happens apart from God, that when something happens, it can only happen because God makes it happen. So the most natural but flawed thing for Job to conclude is that because what he has been seeing and experiencing is unfair, and it couldn't happen unless God made it happen, then God in his character must be unfair. Did you get that? Now, that's where Job is in his understanding of the sovereignty of God, but saints, it is a changing. It is a changing. So, then let me ask you this. When bad things happen, things like what happened to Job, or the bad things that have happened in your own life, who caused them to happen? Who caused them to happen? Well, let's refer back to chapters 1 and 2. What did we see there? We saw that as the sovereign God of the universe, God governs his creation through the intermediate agency of a number of supernatural forces, the sons of God, some of which are evil, right? Some of which are evil. It's there that we discovered that God uses evil to work out his purposes. To work out his purposes to do what? To defeat evil. And if he didn't, Romans 8:28, which says, God causes what? All things being what? Good and evil, right? God causes all things to work together for what? Good. That includes evil. To work for the good of those who love God, to those who are called according to his purposes. Now, if that weren't so, then this verse in Romans 8 would not mean a thing. It wouldn't mean a thing. There are two passages in the Old Testament about the same event that illustrates this truth. One is in 2 Samuel 24:1 that says, God incited David to take a census of Israel and Judah. The parallel account of this event, this same event, is in 1 Corinthians 21:1. And it says this. It says, Satan rose up and incited David to take a census of Israel. So who was it? Was it God or Satan who incited David to sin by numbering the people? Who was it? Now what looks and sounds like a contradiction to many is often explained this way. In order to achieve his desired ends, God sometimes sovereignly permits Satan to act, right? We've certainly seen that in Job's case, didn't we? As we've already seen in previous messages in Job, Satan is God's pawn. God created him, and he uses him to accomplish his purposes in whatever way he so desires, with the results being the refining, the disciplining, and the purification of disobedient believers. You see that in Luke 22, where Jesus told Peter that Satan had asked his permission to sift him like wheat. And then in 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 5, Paul tells the believers at Corinth to excommunicate a member of the church who was living in adultery with his mother. And then in the second chapter, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 to 10, Paul said that he had been given a thorn in the flesh and a messenger of Satan to buffet him. Why? To keep him from being prideful. So this we see that in these verses. And this is what I believe happened with David. Now listen. God allowed Satan to tempt him, and when he did, David sinned, revealing his pride. And then God dealt with David accordingly. So you see, God used Satan to reveal David's sin of pride, which in the end did what? It worked out for his good. It worked out for his good, but more importantly, it worked out for God's glory. So you see, God used evil to bring about good. So the answer to the question, who was it that incited David? It's both God and Satan. It was both of them who incited David to number the people, but in different ways. I'm going to try to explain that. One commentator, because I didn't understand it, so I had to do some reading and digging. But one commentator helped me understand it like this. The characteristic perspective, now listen to this closely, of the writer of Samuel and Kings is that if something happens, it happens because God does it, and that's Job's understanding as well as his friends. Now, when the writer of Chronicles says that Satan did it, he is not denying that the Lord did it. The writer of Chronicles is not a dualist. He does not believe Satan has an existence independent from the Lord, or that he can exercise autonomy in his actions. The writer of Chronicles draws attention to the fact that this action is God's actions by God's instrument. Did you get that? God's actions by God's instrument, which in this case is Satan. Get it? Okay. It is therefore God's action in a different way from some of God's other actions. In other words, some of God's actions express his character, while others are the outworkings of his longer plan to deal with evil. So when God acts in steadfast love and faithfulness, these actions express his character directly. But when evil things happen, God is acting through the agencies of evil powers, but the actions do not reveal his character. They are part of his grand plan to turn evil to good, to defeat evil. And that's why we can say all things work together for good. But they do not immediately reveal God's character. And it's this distinction that Job has not yet been able to wrap his mind around. Job struggling through all this will help us as we too struggle to discern the character and nature of God in a disordered and confused world. After listening to Bildad, Job begins his response in verse 2, and he says, "In truth, I know that this is so," or "yes, I know that all you say is true in principle, but how can a man be right before God? Or how can a person be declared innocent in God's sight? If one wished to dispute with him, he could not answer him once in a thousand times." Verses 2 and 3. Job's question is not an inquiry as to the way of salvation, but an expression of the hopelessness of ever proving his innocence in court before one so great as the sovereign God of the universe. Now, you remember last week, back in chapter 8, verse 3, Bildad, as forcefully as he possibly could, declared that God never twists justice, that he always does what is right. And then in verse 20 states that God never rejects a person of integrity nor lends a hand to the wicked. And in those statements, Bildad is absolutely correct. And Job admits that he's right, at least in principle. However, we must be careful to understand what Job is saying here. His problem, and we'll see that he has several problems, is basically that he and his friends have an inadequate theology which can lead to false convictions or beliefs about God. All four of them approach life, Job and his three friends, all approach life with the same basic outlook. And Job accepts the principle that his friends embrace. That trouble comes only because of sin. In other words, Job would have analyzed your problems, my problems, the same way his friends did his before he was afflicted. Up until the day his troubles began, Job would have agreed with Eliphaz and Bildad because that was the unquestioned worldview of them all. But Job's worldview is a change. His dilemma, and he has one, is caused by the fact that in the long, dark hours of the night, as he searched his own heart, as he lay upon the ash heap of suffering, he has just not been able to put his finger upon any sin that he hasn't already dealt with. He was a righteous and a blameless man. Even God said that he was in chapters 1 and 2, which means that when he was aware of any evil in his life, he didn't try to cover it up, but brought the offerings, made the sacrifices, and accepted God's forgiveness. Now, he had done that. He had done that, but still the torment goes on. Still, his pain and suffering goes on. So his dilemma is, I'm not aware of any sin in my life, yet the trouble is there. Therefore, the problem must lie where? It has to lie with God, because the problem's not with me. That's where Job is. But Job has another dilemma. He has another problem. He has no way to examine or to question God about his first dilemma. He says to Bildad, "Oh, I know you're right, but," and that's where the rub lies, with the "but." "But How long can a man be, how can a man be right before God? Well, frankly, I see that as one of life's most, it's the ultimate question of life. How can a man be right before God? When we're back in chapter 4, verse 7, when hearing Eliphaz heard a voice that assured him that it's not even a possibility. It's not possible for a mere man to be right before God. Here's what he said. Here's the question. Can mankind be just before God? Chapter 4, verse 7. And of course, the expected answer was what? No. It's not even possible. And yet, we see it over and over again and again in the book of Job. Why? Because it's what Job most longs for. It's the greatest desire of his heart. He longs to stand before God. He longs to be right with God. He longs to be justified and acquitted in God's eyes. More than he wants his health, his wealth, or his family back, he longs to be right with God. His desire for God is there, but his understanding of God has a long way to go. One writer put it this way: our deepest desires reveal the worship of our hearts. And Job's deepest desire is to stand before God and be acquitted, but he doesn't know how. He doesn't know how. Idolaters, they long most deeply for what their idols promise, whether it be success or comfort or fame or sexual gratification, whatever. But in his ragged desperation, the deepest desire of Job's heart is revealed. He longs for God, but he sees no way he'll ever be able to stand before him and be declared innocent. And even if someone wanted to contend with God in court, would it be possible to answer him? Job says, would it be possible to answer him once in 1,000 times? Probably not. But why is that? Why is that? Well, Job makes it clear because God is what? He's wiser. He's stronger than we are. Who in the world could challenge him successfully? It's what Job is asking in verse 4. Who could do that? The sheer impossibility, now listen, the sheer impossibility of standing before God in court is the main burden of Job's speech in this entire chapter. Job is simply facing up to the impossibility of ever achieving the deepest longings of his heart, proving his innocence and being made right with God. That's what he wants more than anything. Now, Bildad argues that God is both sovereign and just, but Job builds his argument on God's divine sovereignty alone. Alone. Job believes in the sovereignty of God, but considering his circumstances, he finds it hard to believe that God is just. So what does that tell us? What does it tell us? Well, it tells us that as far as Job is concerned, it's sheer folly to contend with God, since he is sovereign, all-wise, and all-powerful, as seen in his control of the mountains in verse 5, the earth, verse 6, the sun and the stars, verse 7, the heavens and the seas, verse 8, the constellations, verse 9. And not only that, he works wonders without number. But notice, as far as Job is concerned, God has turned the creation on its head. He overturns the mountains. He shakes the earth until the foundations tremble. And if it serves his purposes, he can command the sun and the stars to quit shining. The very things he created, ordered, set in motion in the very beginning, God, and God said what's good. Job accuses God of turning it upside down. Once again, where Job is concerned, God, far from keeping the moral order of the universe, actually replaces it with disorder. Why? Because that was what Job saw taking place in his own life. His life of stability has been like the mountains turned on his head, turned upside down. The light in his life, his family, like the sun and the stars, they have grown dark. And yes, God has performed many miracles, but in Job's mind, among those miracles are things that are evil, disordered things. So Job blames God for the cosmic disorder that happens both in creation and now in his life. God is sovereign and in control of all things. So in Job's mind, if it happens, then who's the cause? God must be the cause. If what Job believes is true, then what hope does he have in such a chaotic courtroom against an angry God of such disorder and confusion? Even though we know that God is not the author of confusion, 1 Corinthians 14:33, Job is convinced that he is. Job has yet another problem, another dilemma, and that's God's elusiveness. How in the world? He's thinking, how in the world could I ever get hold of a God so wise, so mighty, so furious, and invisible, and then try to debate with him the issues that are causing all the hurt and pain and suffering in his life? They have the same problem. Where? Were he to pass by me, I wouldn't see him. Were he to move past me, I would not perceive him. Were he to snatch away, who could restrain him? Who could say to him, what are you doing? God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him crouched the helpers of Rahab. Now, I have not a clue what that means, the helpers of Rahab, except that it may be a reference to Egypt. So I'm not going to take time to deal with it right now. I'll find out, and when I do, I'll tell you. Now, Job, he's wondering, what chance do I have if he comes near me? I mean, after all, I can't see him. He's invisible. If he moves by me, I can't see him go by. If he snatches someone to death, well, who's going to stop him? And who dares to ask him what he's doing anyway? He can pass me by, move on, come close to me, do me harm, take my possessions, my children. What chance do I have against such an elusive God? And then besides all that, he is too strong for me. I am no match for him. How then can I answer him and choose my words before him? For though I was right, see, he's declaring his righteousness there, I could not answer. I would have to implore the mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I could not believe that he was listening to my voice, for he bruises me with a tempest and multiplies my words without cause. He will not allow me to get my breath, but saturates me with bitterness. If it is a matter of power, behold, there it is. He is too strong for me. And if it is a matter of justice, who can summons him? Though I am righteous, my mouth will condemn me. Though I am guiltless, he will declare me guilty. Now Job's convinced that it's absurd to think he might stand a chance of winning his case in court against God. And even if he's right about his innocence, and he is, we know that from chapters 1 and 2, even though he's innocent. He doesn't believe he can defend himself against God, or that he'd be able all he'd be able to do is plead for mercy. That's all he'd be able to do. And even if Job were able to summons God to court and he responded, Job doesn't believe God's going to listen to anything he has to say. He thinks God will just plug his ears. He'll just be deaf to anything he says. And then in verse 17, God accuses him of crushing him with a tempest or of wounding him without cause. It's all your fault, God. In Job's mind, God is more like a street brawler than a lawyer, one who just knocks the wind out of him, hits him right here in the plexus before he's even had time to catch his breath, verse 18. And someone said that to be in court against the God that Job is describing would be like trying to make a rational speech during a hurricane, and all to no avail. And if it all boils down to a question of strength, who's the strong one? God is. Verse 19. He's so strong, I can never overpower him. I can never outreason him. And if it's a matter of justice, who would be so stupid as to summon him to court anyway? Verse 19. So you see that even though Job is innocent, he believes his own mouth would convict him. He says, though I am blameless, there he is. He confesses his innocence. My own mouth would prove me wicked in God's presence. Verse 20. Now I think what Job is trying to say here is that he would be so mystified, so awed and scared before the majestic God of the universe that he wouldn't be able to say what was actually on his mind or what he wanted to say. Like, I can't say some of the things I want to say sometimes. That he would be so terrified that he'd just make a fool of himself. Now, I think that's what he means by this. Maybe you got some other ideas. But Job, as we've seen, knows he's innocent. But he said it doesn't make any difference anyway in verse 21. Because he despises his life so much. This present life that he's living, he just despises it. I can understand why. And besides that, it doesn't matter to God whether I'm innocent or not, is what Job is saying. It's all the same to him. That's why Job said God destroys both the blameless and the wicked in verse 22. And then Job goes so far as to accuse God of laughing at the death of the innocent when a plague sweeps through the land in verse 23. And then in verse 24, Job states that the whole earth is in the hands of the wicked, and that God is the one responsible because he's the one that blinds the eyes of the judges. Job's on a roll. And if he's not the one, he asks, well, then who is? He actually accuses God of all the wickedness in the world. In Job's mind, it couldn't be any other way since God is what? Sovereign. Right. Job just wishes, too, as we've already seen in past messages, that God, just let me die. I mean, I'm so miserable. Just let me die. Now, to be sure, his desire is to meet God in court before he dies. But then, he can't see how justice would prevail since God is so schizophrenic. So then, if I can't get justice, then just let me die. Besides that, God doesn't give a rip one way or the other. It's all the same to him. He's going to destroy us all anyway, both the guilty and the innocent. He's the judge, the jury, the prosecutor, all rolled up into one. And furthermore, he's not even going to bother with a trial. It's a good thing I'm not God. Of course, all this flies in the face of what Bildad said back in chapter 8, verse 3 about God being just. Job, in essence, is saying, I'm innocent. Yet God is destroying me, and there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing fair or just about it. And you know what? If we could prove that kind of unfairness of a human judge, we'd be screaming for his resignation, wouldn't we? Sure we would. We'd be screaming for it. And that's what Job is doing. He is effectively calling on God to resign as judge of all the earth. Job's contemporary, Abraham, asked this question in Genesis 28, 25. Will not the judge of all the earth deal justly, or will he not do the right thing? You know, I'm sure Job wishes that Abraham, what Abraham said were true, but Job's experiences says that it's not. You know, I've often wondered why God puts up with the likes of us. And after hearing and reading all that Job has accused God of, it's become even a greater mystery to me. It's a good thing. Like I said, it's a good thing I'm not God. I'd give him his wish. I would. But I'm not God. Thankfully, I'm not. He accuses God of mocking and laughing when something like the bubonic plague kills thousands upon thousands of people. Yet in Ezekiel 18, it says that God takes no pleasure in the death of anyone. And Ezekiel 33 takes it even further. He says he takes no pleasure in the death of the what? The wicked. Right now, Job doesn't see things that way. He doesn't see God in that light. He sees God as a tyrant who gets some kind of wicked and sadistic pleasure from the death of both the guilty and the innocent. In verse 24, Job has accused God of giving the entire world over to the wicked. Now it's true. The earth is filled with wickedness. There is injustice everywhere. Many judges do not judge righteously. That's why we have Roe versus Wade and the destruction of millions upon millions of babies. Job blames God for covering their faces, which I think means that God literally distorts their ability to reason. He distorts their judgment. When this kind of injustice takes place, who's the one causing it? According to Job's theology, it happens. If it happens, it happens because why? God is sovereign. He's the one that causes it to happen. If it's not Him, if it's not God that causes it to happen, then who is it? In Job's mind, it could only be God. Job is aware that there is something terribly wrong with saying that God actively and intentionally is guilty of such injustice. But if he is to maintain his belief in the sovereignty of God, what other assumption can he possibly come to? Considering his theology and his circumstances, it's not hard to understand why he has come to his convictions about God. Bad theology leads to a lot of false conclusions. Now, Job complains that his life is, faster than a speeding bullet. I don't know why. But he says that it's passing before him faster than a speeding runner. And if that speeding runner was me, it wouldn't be all that fast. But he also said, without a glimmer of hope or happiness at all, in verse 25. That is, vanishing as swiftly as a papyrus boat, and faster than an eagle when it swoops down on his prey, verse 26. He's saying that his life could end at any moment. So then what can I do, he asks. What can I do? And he proposes three solutions. First, one, he says, I could quit complaining and put on a happy face. I could do that, verses 27 through 29. But even if I quit griping and put away my sad face and become cheerful, I'd still dread all the pain. And then you'd still find me. You still wouldn't find me innocent. Whatever happens, you would still find me guilty. So why even try? You can hear Job's despair in these verses. Why can Job not cheer up? I think because his suffering goes deeper than his pain or the loss of his possessions and his children. It's the judgment of God against sinners that has him in such despair. He knows God is not going to find him innocent. That's why he says in verse 28, I know that you will not acquit me. His present suffering is bad enough, but what he truly fears is the suffering he believes he'll experience when he does die. So then, what's the use? There's no point in continuing to labor in vain, verse 29. Why should I keep trying or even thinking about being made right before God? It's just a pipe dream that will never come to pass. His second solution to his problem is, well, I could take a bath. In verses 30 through 31, I could wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, but then you'd just turn right around and throw me in a muddy ditch somewhere. And the result would be that my own filthy clothing would abhor me. Job could, as he has most likely done hundreds of times as he lay upon the ash heap, examined his heart and his conscience to make sure that he was clean, that there was no secret sin in his life that could have caused all this misery. Now, I can't see how washing with snow would be any better than washing with soap and water. Verse 30, I think it's probably an expression that means wash so that he'll be whiter than snow. But it doesn't matter how clean he gets. It doesn't matter. Job's absolutely convinced that God is so against him, he'll do whatever it takes to prove that he's filthy. To Job, God is like his worst enemy, who would take him hostage right after he'd finished bathing and then throw him into a foul, filthy, vile-smelling pit and so cover him with the stench of death that his own clothes would abhor him. And it's not that Job would feel terrible in his foul-smelling clothes, but that his clothes would feel terrible, because they were clothing his foul-smelling, pus-ridden, filthy body. And so, where are we? Where does that leave Job? His only hope is what? A mediator. A mediator. Job argues that God is not mortal like himself, therefore he can't argue with him or take him to court. But if there were a mediator, someone who could stand between him and God, someone who could bring the two together, someone that could make God stop beating him up so that he would no longer live in terror of his punishment. Then he could speak to God without fear, but he knows without a mediator, he can't defend himself in his own strength. Is Job right? Job is right. God is not a man, verse 31. He's not mortal. He's spirit, John 4:24. And the transcendence of God is another of Job's problems. He knows there's no chance of a fair trial. He believes that the deck is stacked against him. So what chances does he have against the sovereign, all-powerful God of the universe? What Job needs is someone who perfectly understands both sides of the argument. He needs an umpire, someone who is able to make sure that sanity and rule of law is kept. Now, I don't know if Job is mourning the absence of a mediator or wishing there was a mediator, but either way, he believes he desperately needs someone who not only understands but sympathizes with his complaint against God. Job needs someone who can lay his hands upon the shoulder of them both. Look at verse 33. What Job needs is someone who perfectly understands him as a man and perfectly understands God as God. He needs someone who can bridge the gap between an infinite God and a finite man, and only the God-man can do that. So what Job needs is a mediator of 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5. For there is one God and one mediator also between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. What does Job need? He needs Jesus Christ. He needs what we all need, a go-between, a middleman to stand between us and God. So let me close with these words. As Job continues to suffer, he becomes more and more frustrated. While Job remained loyal to God, and we'll see that throughout the course of this whole book, he made statements, like he did in this chapter, that he came to regret. But in times of suffering, especially extended suffering and prolonged pain, the most natural thing in the world is for people to begin to have doubts, begin to question God, to despair, and to lose patience. And during those times, what do people need? They need someone that will listen to them, not condemn them, but listen to them. Not condemn them like Eliphaz and Bildad did. They need someone to help them work through their feelings and their frustrations. And so you and I, we need to be patient with our brothers and sisters in Christ who suddenly become sick. I'm thinking of Vicki Antonassi. I'm thinking of Karen Brown and others who have become sick. We need to come alongside of them, listen to them, just sit down with them. You know, sometimes you don't have to say a word, just sit with them. Let them know you love them. Let them know you're there. And we need to be as patient with them as the Lord Jesus Christ has been with us. Amen. It's your ball game.